Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to go through some halachas with you on various issues of infertility and halacha. And the way I wanted to do this, since it's a shortened, we have a shortened opportunity together, is to spend the first 15-20 minutes making a presentation which focuses on making sure we're on a somewhat similar plane on dealing with the metzias, and then we'll peruse through some of the halachas that I've put together for you. Okay? So I'm going to stand over here. You'll excuse me. I'm an immigrant to technology here, so I'll stand over here and I'll just explain. And if anyone has any questions, feel free to ask during while we start. So the first thing is, let's talk about some of the ABCs of treating infertility. And some of the myths about infertility is that infertility is a woman's problem, or infertility is a result of stress or certain forms of inadequacy. Another thing that's important to recognize is that not every single time where a woman goes through any type of a checkup, any type of gynecological checkup or any type of checkup which deals with issues of infertility, does it automatically make her a nida. And that's an important thing to know. We're not going to go into great depth on that because we don't have enough time, but if someone wants to study that, there are many different and wonderful articles on that. I actually have an article in the Journal of Contemporary Halacha on this issue where I go through the sugyas of nida and basically all of the exams that were around at that time. They haven't really changed that much, and explain how each one interfaces with the halachas of nida. I think anyone who's going into the Rabbanis should be familiar with that, and I know that Rabbi Simon gives that out in his Nida, when he teaches Nida. But if you want to look, you can email me, or you can just simply go to the Journal of Contemporary Halacha and look for it yourself. So, in understanding this, when there is some type of check that is done, the check that's normally done begins in the vaginal area. Dom, that we would consider Nida Dom, is from the os, normally an internal os, through the endometrium lining. And therefore, very rarely when an OBGYN does any type of test will he get anywhere near the area which is called Dom of Dom Nida Dom, the Dom in Amunga. So even though there might be bleeding that happens afterwards because this area is very sensitive, it's very likely that it has really nothing to do with Dom Nida. And continuing on that issue, again, just explaining that the normal anatomy is the vaginal area, the cervix, the endometrium lining, which is really what is Dom in Amakar, and the ovaries in which the female gametes are held and released every single month from a different side. And if there is a obstruction in one of the fallopian tubes, you will immediately cut down your fertility opportunities by 50%. And sometimes that can be one of the major issues. And we'll go through a little bit more of this. So as I explained, the fallopian tube releases there is a release into the fallopian tube from the ovaries, and the way the release happens, or when ovulation happens, is there's a buildup of various hormones, and as the hormones are building up, so is the endometrium lining preparing for a fertilized egg. So this lining that I showed you before is growing in preparation for the ovulation of the egg, and fertilization happens somewhere over here, and then as that fertilized egg comes, it either attaches to the wall or there's a whisper of death and it just departs, and therefore the lining of the endometrium lining sloughs off, and that is how a woman menstruates. And this shows you exactly what I just said. Here are just some basic definitions of infertility. One out of every six couples
have infertility challenges. Definition of infertility in the medical community is when you have been trying for more than a year, and it's pretty split. It's either due to the male or the female, 40% each way, and sometimes it's a combined challenge. It could be that the female has some obstructions that make it challenging, but if the male had a tremendous amount of sperm count, or the morphology of the sperm was more perfect, that it would obviate the challenge, but the challenge is together, or the pH factor sometimes in the cervix could be a challenge, but if the male had more sperm, the pH factor would not deter all the sperm from being destroyed in the cervix area. And so therefore, you have various challenges, either male, female, or combined challenges. And the in female infertility, either it's an ovulatory disturbance, certain types of anatomical distortions, tubal blockage, I mentioned to you, adhesion, some scarring on the endometrium lining, endometriosis, which is a form of the endometrial lining has been compromised and has various infection or other challenges to it, or unexplained. Male infertility could be men with sperm, men without sperm. And what is the role of a Rav? The role of the Rav is to provide counseling, spiritual support, halachic instruction. A Rav eventually, as he plays a role within this community, will get to know physicians, will have conversations with the physicians, and therefore he'll be able to refer physicians and have a physician-patient and sometimes play a liaison role between the physician and the patient when there are halachic issues that come up, and they do in many cases. What are improper roles for rabbis? To give out herbs and potions. I'm pretty sure no one would do this here, but these are all not things I've made up. These are situations where people have come to me after this has happened, amulets of some type, dispensing prescriptions. There are some rabbis who think they can ask their local doctors for Clomid and other things of that nature and start giving it out. I think you're the only one to do that. And saying you don't need to go to a doctor or things of that nature. These are very improper roles for Rav. And there are various types of diagnostic testing. There's endocrine testing, and that is a testing of the hormones. There's pelvic exams. There's analysis of sperm. There's what we call a PCT test, and that is after the husband and wife have a sexual relation, to remove the sperm, and I'll show it to you, to remove the sperm and test the sperm, and I'll explain that more in depth. There's what we call an endometrial biopsy, in which you take off a piece of the endometrial lining to evaluate it and make sure there aren't certain challenges there. There's what we call an HSG, otherwise known as a histosalpingogram, and the reason why it's called an HSG isn't too complicated. It comes from HSG, or laparoscopy, or some forms of ultrasound. So we'll discuss all of those also. And there are treatment strategies, medical, surgical, forms of insemination, and in vitro fertilization. So let's just look at some of these treatments. So a histosalpingogram, and the reason why can give you the ability to check how does the cervix, how does the uterus look? And what you can do is basically you put a dye in and you basically are able to take a picture. I am not giving you a fully developed understanding of a histosalpingogram. I'm giving you enough that allows me to do this in a very short period of time. But essentially, a dye is put in, and you've taken a picture of it, and you're able to tell if there, for example, are there problems in, for example, over here you have a fibroid tumor that is closing the fallopian tube, and therefore what's happening here is every time an egg is released, the capacity for it to be inseminated is almost impossible, which means her fertility potential has been cut by 50%. And therefore, if you remove this fibroid tumor, you would be able to deal with some of those issues. There are other challenges on this side with other issues. We're not going to go into all of those right now, but I just wanted to give you an example. But here is an example, give you a little better example of various forms of histosapenograms that can tell us what the uterus looks like. Here's an example where there is no, nothing that happens inside the uterus itself, other than there is a clamp that opens up the vaginal area, and then the dye is inserted. There's nothing that happens here, although it will create blood, but there's no need here. My point is that many times there'll be cases in which a woman will have blood, which is not equal nida.
Then there is something called an endometrial biopsy. Here is when you basically take the lining of the endometrium and you take a biopsy of it in order to be able to evaluate what is happening in the endometrium. Sometimes there can be certain challenges in endometrium, and sometimes there could be cancerous cells there, there could be other issues, and the endometrial biopsy gives you a better understanding of what's happening simply by then looking at the endometrial lining and doing tests on the endometrial lining after you remove a piece of it. Here you will have blood coming from the makar, but if there isn't a dilation of the cervix, which depending on what instrument is used, sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. So if you dilate the cervix, you have what's called psichas kever, eifshar psichas kever below dam. But if you're just taking a piece from over here, that's damaka, right? Even though it's from the location, it's damaka. And most poskim would concur that this is not a halachic concern. Okay? So therefore, it's just important to recognize those issues. Even though you'll be bleeding from the makar, that's not an issue. And there are some procedures, like this one, in which nothing happens in the uterus vaginal area, but there will be some people who say, oh, you had an OBGYN procedure, you're a nida right away, even though what's happening here is the checking of the outside of the anatomical area, the physiological area, just to evaluate the fallopian tube, the ovaries, and things of that nature. But again, sometimes lack of knowledge causes people to be machmir in quotes when they're actually being mako on pur revu, ona, and a host of other mitzvahs d'oraisa.
Then there are ultrasounds, various forms of surgeries that would fix some of these issues, like remove a fibroid and things of that nature, so that there is a regular cavity in the uterus that will promote the ability for there to be a better chance for the woman to get pregnant. Sometimes we will try to make sure that a woman, she's having difficulties. Again, we don't have time to go into what polycystic ovaries are and things of that nature, but what we try to do is sometimes we will figure out a way to induce ovulation in order to make sure that women can ovulate. They'll take certain hormones, and that's why sometimes when women go through these types of treatments, you'll notice they have twins. And the reason why they'll have twins is because the ovulation sometimes is happening either from both sides, or the ovulation is happening in a way in which it's not only for IVF, because the ovulation is happening that there is multiple release of from the ovaries, and therefore if more than one egg is fertilized, you will have at times twins. So sometimes you'll see women who haven't had children for a whole bunch of years, all of a sudden they have twins. It's a gift of God through the gift of science. Then there is testing of sperm. There is from the normal sperm on your far left to the abnormal sperm. And what you're looking for in sperm is, first of all, the morphology of sperm, namely how it looks, and the sperm count per cc's. The more sperm you have, the better it is, because perhaps the best way of explaining it is that when sperm travel up to the fallopian tube, I would the entire endometrium lining, the uterus, the cervix area, is like the FDR drive. There are a lot of potholes on the way. Okay, and what happens is the sperm die. But if there's millions of sperm that are traveling upstream to the fallopian tube, all you need is one to be able to impregnate the egg. And therefore, sometimes what will happen is there'll be what we call a PCT test, in which you remove sperm after there's been a sexual relation between husband and wife, and you'll evaluate the sperm from a halakhic perspective, as we will get to, because we're going to stop this by 12:30 so we can go through the halakhic issues. You will, it's the best way, because there's no need to in any ways ejaculate sperm other than the normal darko bakach. But sometimes you don't get a clear picture with a PCT test because there's a whole bunch of other debris in the way, namely the namely fluids from the woman, and therefore you might not get the best microscopic view. And here is an example of a PCT test where you have receptive mucus versus non-receptive mucus. And this is an example where a man might have limited sperm and the woman might have non-receptive mucus, the pH or other things killing the sperm, but if he had more sperm, it would be able to penetrate that mucus. And here's an example of a joint challenge. And therefore, sometimes the way we deal with issues is, I already explained this, these are some of the challenges. So sometimes what we'll do is what we call an IUI, an intrauterine insemination. And what we do is we simply put the sperm in a, we put the sperm into this like thing, it looks like a shot. And what happens is, and we park it right near the fallopian tube. So it's a flyover all of the bumpy roads of the cervix and of the endometrium lining, of the cervix of the uterus, and therefore it gets parked right here with a better chance of fertilization. This is the most non-invasive way of dealing with treatment challenges. Where you wash the sperm, you put them in a sterile medium. The sperm is then put in, injected directly into the uterus, so it just needs to travel straight into the fallopian tube for insemination. We spoke about ovulation induction. You know, here are some of the challenges. Some of the challenges is that sometimes, can you do an IUI, can you do intrauterine insemination into the woman when it's the right time for her, but she hasn't yet gone to the mikvah? In other words, we know that she's ovulated, so we know that egg has been released. It's traveling through the fallopian tube. You can tell by hormone, by the level of hormones, you can tell by other ways, and therefore you want to insert the sperm by the fallopian tube, but she's not yet gone to mikvah. There's no sexual relationship here, there's no intimacy here. Can you do an IUI prior to mikvah? Challenges sometimes with multi-fetal pregnancies. What happens if she has many, she's now pregnant with three, and the doctor says she cannot hold all three, and in order for her to survive and for any of the fetuses to survive, there needs to be fetal reduction. What does halakha say about that? We will not have a chance to go into all of those issues. And then the issue of hashgacha. How do you deal with the issue of hashgacha? Why do you need hashgacha? This is not an OU plant. The answer is you need hashgacha because there are some times in which there are mix-ups that happen where embryologists fail to correct their mistakes, or this is an old article, or on CNN, there is this couple that got a mazel tov that she knew she was pregnant. There was an entire fertilization process that happened in the lab, except they're shocked because they found out they're implanted with another couple's embryo. So when they give birth, they need to take that child and bring it to the couple whose embryo it is. If you click on this, and I can send you this link,
you'll hear the whole interview. I don't think we have the time to hear it, but I think that we've made the point.
Pregnancy rates.
We try to make sure that our pregnancy rates, when we do IVF procedures, and we'll get into IVF in a minute, is we're not, depending on the age, it's the age of the woman, we want to try to go for single or twins, not for triplets, because of the challenges we just talked about. And therefore, deciding how many, and we'll get to IVF in a second, to decide how many fertilized eggs to return is a halakhic issue that is often directed by the doctor, but you should be aware of also. What is IVF? IVF is the following. Instead of, let's say you have, we all know, hopefully we all know, that the way that an embryo begins is a fertilized zygote. And what happens is, it's the sperm of the male and the egg of the woman, they're fertilized. Normally that happens in the fallopian tube. If it cannot happen in the body of the woman, in the fallopian tube, we can now fertilize an egg in a laboratory. In vitro fertilization. Fertilization that happens within a lab. The fertilized egg, this is the first stage of a fertilized egg. And then what happens is it continues to grow. And it grows from a beginning of a fertilized egg all of a sudden into an embryo. In vitro fertilization sometimes happens because we're not able to deal with issues. For example, that endometritis that I told you about, where the endometrium lining has challenges to it, and therefore a fertilized egg won't take root at its early stages. There's tubal blockage for the fallopian tubes. There are certain adhesions. There's unexplained infertility. There's severe male infertility, but you can find one sperm because all you need is one to fertilize the egg. And therefore, the basic steps of IVF is you cause many eggs to be released. You create ovulation induction. You then retrieve the eggs. You have to deal with halakhic issues about this because you want to make sure your egg retrieval is not on Shabbos. What happens if it happens to take place on Shabbos? In Eretz Yisrael, they always work it out because the doctors don't want to be there. It doesn't happen on Shabbos. When you live in Boca Raton, Florida, or somewhere else like that, or for that matter, any place maybe outside the New York area, and even in some places in the New York area, sometimes egg retrieval might happen on Shabbos. You can't say, I'll do it on Sunday, Monday, because the woman could be put into a state of sakana if she's ovulating and you do not remove the fertilized, oocytes, until as they develop. If you don't remove them, you could really cause the ovaries to explode, and you could create a compromised situation for the woman. Sperm procurement, then you take the fertilized, you take the eggs, and you create a culture where the eggs and sperm unite, and then there is the embryo transfer. You return one or two eggs, at least. Normally you return at least two eggs to the womb of the woman, and then whatever's left over, you cryopreserve for the future. This is a $20,000 procedure. It's like 1 year of yeshiva tuition, and therefore you don't want to have to do some of this again, and therefore you cryopreserve. This is just a graph that shows you how this happens, the ovulation that happens, the follicles that are stimulated, and there are many follicles that are stimulated because you normally, as I said to you earlier, you have one side, the ovary stimulates a follicle and it's released, and the other side, it stimulates the other one. But you don't have that luxury. You want to stimulate many follicles. And therefore, it gets to a point, you want to retrieve four or five at a shot. If you don't retrieve these, the woman can be in serious danger. Retrieve the eggs, and you do what you need to do, and there's a whole cycle there.
Then the in vitro fertilization happens. The in vitro fertilization happens. You remove the eggs. You then fertilize the eggs in the lab.
And at the blastocyst stage of development, which is four or five cells, you take these embryos and you scoop them back into the womb of the woman with the hope that some of them will take root in the endometrial lining or the endometrium.
This is an example of the fertilization process that happens. Again, once one sperm, binds with the egg, that's it. And sometimes what we do is what's called an ICSI process, and that is, and I'm only telling, this is like the basics, and that is what you do is you're afraid that the female-male gametes can't get together. And so what you do is you take the egg and you actually puncture the egg and put a sperm inside the egg. It's a form of a cyst. It's called, the reason why it's called ICSI again is intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which just means you broke the wall of the egg, you part the sperm inside there, and you assist it in the process of fertilization. This is an example of how this is done, the pipette holding the egg, the inserting of the sperm. Okay, we're going to stop right here and start doing some halakha because that's what this class is supposed to be about, not just doing the medical pieces. I got a few more medical things I want to do, but there's enough halakha pieces to do on what we've just discussed. Any questions? Everyone get this basically? Everyone good? Okay, so let's go through this. So, it's important to recognize the fact that we start off with one point of introduction. Again, I apologize if I'm doing this extremely fast. I'm always around to answer any questions, but I just want to get you to download as much material as I can in a organized way. We start with the first source on page 1, the Gemara in Bava Basra on Daf Yud, which reminds us of an argument between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva. If God likes the poor, why doesn't he mafarnes them? And Rabbi Akiva answers the Roman governor of Judea to save us from Gehenna, and the Roman governor of Judea says just the opposite. You Jews go to Gehenna when you help the poor. Suppose an earthly king incarcerated one of his servants and said no one can give him food or drink, and someone snuck food or drink into his servants. Would not that servant who snuck food or drink be punished? And you, the Jewish people, are considered children, considered servants of God. Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim. You are considered servants of God. And Rabbi Akiva answers, suppose that a human king incarcerated his son and told no one to give him food, and someone snuck in food to his son. Would not the king be happy? And we are called the children of God. Banim atam l'Hashem Elokecha. Rabbi Dr. Twersky, Rabbi Meir Zatzal, Rabbi Meir Twersky's father, has an article in which he takes this idea and develops it beautifully, where he develops the idea that the machlokes between Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus is how do we as partners of a Kaddish Baruch Hu look at the world? Says Turnus Rufus, we wear the lenses of God. If God condemned this person to be poor, what right do you have to change it? If God condemned this couple not to have children, what right do you have to change it? Says Rabbi Akiva, we don't wear the lenses of God. We don't take a providential view on the world. We don't understand what God wants. We're here to take the world that was created and make it better. And the way we make it better is by being God's junior partners, and these are all the children of God. So if we can help somebody move from a state of starvation to a state in which they are fed, if we can help a couple move from a state of infertility to a state in which they have children, we are continuing the creative process that a Kaddish Baruch Hu began. Yet we need to do that through the prism of halacha. And so therefore the Shulchan Aruch reminds us about the prohibition of removing sperm. Motzi shikla zera levatala, removing sperm if we're not having a sexual relation with our spouse. And the Shulchan Aruch goes even further in Sif Bet and tells us an additional prohibition of removing sperm by using one's hands to cause the expression of sperm. And so therefore, how do we deal with the issue of when we need to take a test? We need to take a test on a husband's sperm. So the first thing is, by having that halacha, we learn one important thing. And that is that before we test sperm, we need to make all the tests on women first. In other words, before we check for a male factor
of maybe the male does not have sperm and express sperm, we need to make sure we've checked the blockages issues. We need to make sure we've checked the endometrial lining. We need to follow a protocol of first searching if there are any female infertility issues that does not violate a halakhic process before we aggressively deal with male infertility. A normal OBGYN will not follow that protocol. And here's where the partnership between the Rav, the congregant, and the doctor comes in. Because the Rav needs to give guidance to the doctor and to the couple that you should follow a protocol that is slightly different. It will not compromise the ability to have children. It's just reorchestrating the protocols of which tests are given. And on that level, that's why we sometimes try to do that PCT test, that postcoital test, because there is no motzi shechazer levatala. There was a sexual intercourse, there was a relationship, and then you remove the sperm. It might be embarrassing afterwards to remove the sperm or whatever, but most of the time doctors will say that PCT test has too many disturbances. It has the pH mucus, it has the mucus from the woman, it might have other things in it, and they will not get a clear vision of the sperm itself. So while the doctor might say, okay, we'll try with the PCT test, the doctor will most of the time say, unless it's an easy fertility situation, it's not enough. That's why you have Rav Moshe Feinstein, who strongly suggests that after you've tried to do everything else and you've done the PCT test, that there's nothing wrong with then allowing there to be a test done in which sperm is in some ways expressed, even if it's not a normal sexual relationship, because it's not motzi shechazer levatala, because you're trying to have children. Rav Moshe is concerned about expressing the sperm by using one's hands for the additional iser that is mentioned in Sif Bet. And the normal way that sometimes it's done is that you use a condom. The condom has a hole on the side of the condom, not in the front, because you don't want to lose the sperm. So it's in some ways dark of a cock. And it's a unique condom because most condoms have spermicide in it. If you use a condom with spermicide to capture the sperm, by definition, you're not achieving the goals you want to achieve. So that's one way of doing it. Rav Moshe, again, says that if you need to, you can, he gives other suggestions of how the sperm can be removed. Having a sexual relation and then removing the, and then a husband removing and then expressing the sperm outside of the woman. He goes through a protocol that can be done, but the bottom line is, and you'll see in the next page on the opposite side, you see that Tzitz Eliezer also, that at the end of the day, the Tzitz Eliezer actually permits that if we cannot get, sometimes it's very uncomfortable for a husband and wife, normally it's a young couple, trying to have children, to go through this protocol in which they have to have like a sexual relationship and then the sperm has to be ejaculated somewhere else. It's just too much pressure and it doesn't really work. It's a tense enough time. We have to realize this is extremely tense time for a husband and wife coming to grips with the fact that they might not be able to have children. And therefore, the Tzitz Eliezer says, if there's no other way, then you can even use biadayim in order to get the sperm that the doctor needs in order to be able to have, to check the sperm properly. The Tzitz Eliezer is there for your perusal, at least a summary of it is there, but I wanted you just to be recognized. So the first thing is, when we need to deal with a male factor, that's one of the ways we deal with it. We check the sperm, either using a PCT test or having the sperm being expressed. And another way, either using that condom that has no spermicide in it, that's the easiest halakhic way, or if necessary, even the yadayim in order to be able to have the necessary sperm in order to see if there is a male factor in the infertility challenge. Okay? Now, let's turn to the next page, page 3. Yes?
What's the reason that the doctors have to use the opposite protocol?
Because the doctors, what?
They're
not very strong. I have not, in my experience, have not found them to be very strong. I think that basically, it's a very easy test to check for sperm. It's just very easy. Why should I start doing all these HSG, histosalpingograms, and everything else tests? I want to just check for the sperm. It's a 15-minute ordeal.
Doesn't
Right, it's not invasive, it's nothing, it's 15 minutes. Just let's get this one over with already. So that's why they're doing it. So therefore, you have to switch that order around. That's a key factor in any conversation. You gotta change that order around. Key factor, even from infertility specialists, sometimes don't follow the protocol I just articulated, and you need to have conversations with them. Don't expect that even if the infertility specialist is from, that they will always follow the protocol that I just articulated. Okay? So it's just important to recognize that. And what? Yes.
Are doctors generally okay with rabbis telling them to alter their orders?
I find that doctors are okay if the rabbis actually know what they're talking about. If the rabbi has some basic knowledge and doesn't pretend to be a doctor, but is not a nar on the issue, and can say what a histosalpingogram is and what a PCT test, and knows what the sperm, and knows these various tests, and reads and understands these materials. I sat this Shabbos with someone from the CDC, and he just sent me 20 articles on whether after doing IVF procedures, are children of IVF procedures, do they have more birth abnormalities versus others? There's a whole literature on it. And I will, by next week, have read through all of that material. If you can talk, again, I was very careful not to use serious medical terms in the presentation here, because I'm not here to show off. I'm here to just make sure you understand the Messias. But I think that you don't have to become this expert. If you have a conversation with a doctor, and you talk to a doctor in a way in which you explain to them your concerns, I find the doctors are very accommodating for two reasons. One is they want to be accommodating. Two, you are a calling card for future business for them. Okay? You are. If you have a good relationship with an infertility specialist and you're a rabbi of a shul, it's not the last time you're going to be dealing together. And therefore, they accommodate you because they know that you are, and that you become a, and it's not a negative thing. You become an unbelievable point of light for them. And I don't mean it in a negative way. Okay? We deal with, what about issues, for example, and I'm going to deal with some of them right now. I mentioned the case of IVF. So in the case of IVF here, we're talking about where it's the woman's eggs, it's the husband's sperm, and it's the same woman's womb. Okay? It's all the same two people. What happens if the woman has certain medical challenges where she cannot hold the baby? Let's say there are certain blood challenges. She cannot hold the baby, the fertilized egg, the embryo. So it's her egg, but this womb belongs to somebody else. Okay? It's Leah's eggs and Rachel's womb. Who's the mother? Or what happens if Leah can do both of these things, but the husband doesn't have sperm? So they use someone else's sperm. They go to www.sperm.com, they order someone else's sperm, they use someone else's sperm. What are the halakhas on those issues? So that's the next set of sources that we're going to look at for a few minutes. And that is, what defines paternity, what defines maternity? So when it comes to defining paternity, namely, who is the father, there is really no machlokas on that, and that is the sperm donor is the definition of father. So, I've given you a whole bunch of sources on this issue. Again, we have limited time, so I'm going to show you from source number 4 on page 3, where source number 4 on page 3 is Gemara in Chagiga, which speaks about the idea of, can a basula who's pregnant marry a Kohen Gadol? Psula cannot marry, a Kohen Gadol cannot marry a woman who is not a Psula. But can you bifurcate a Psula? Can she be pregnant and still be a Psula? So there's So the Gemara says maybe this is a case of Shmuel, where Shmuel says he knows how to have relations, and the hymen is not removed, so therefore she thinks she's a psula, but she's really not a psula. So the Gemara says, no, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a case where a woman can get pregnant in a bathhouse, where the woman uses the same bathhouse as the man used earlier. There's sperm in the water, and the woman becomes inseminated through that sperm, and she becomes pregnant. Now, it's important to recognize that while scientifically I don't think that's a reality here, that's not what the Gemara's intent is. The Gemara's intent is to bifurcate. Can you bifurcate pregnancy and virginity as two different issues? And the Gemara wants to do that to define what is the issue with a kohen. But the tangential benefit for our conversation from that issue within the Gemara is that the Beis Shmuel mentions in source number, in the next source, Rehul 5-ish, in Hilchos Peri of Arivya, page 3, the bottom source, that if a woman has a is inseminated by sperm found in a bathhouse, then the father is the son is beno l'chol davar. The son is the son for all things. So if the father is a kohen, the son is a kohen. If the father has a Yerusha, the son would get the Yerusha. When the father passes away, the son needs to sit Shiva. And so here we see that even without the act of intimacy, it is the sperm donor that defines paternity. That issue is also highlighted. I just bring the next source on page 4, where the issue of this approach is mentioned, Bein Lekula, Bein Lechumra, and quotes a Rashi there. We don't have time to get into it. But it also is found, if you turn on page 5, where it says, Matsati in the Bach, Matsati Bahagos Smag. It's not the Sefer Mitzvah's Katan, it's actually the Sefer Mitzvah's Gadol. It's a printing mistake in here. Shekasav Isha Nida, Yechola Lishka Vastine Bala, Vnizharos Mesedinim Sheshacha Valehem. In other words, what the Bach is saying here is, it's an important comment. The Bach is saying, we have a halacha that a woman cannot sit on used bed sheets of another man. Why? We're afraid maybe there's sperm there, and therefore she'll get pregnant, and we're concerned that maybe Shema Yisa Basachoso, we won't know exactly who the father is, and maybe this child will marry a stepbrother or stepsister. But the Gemara, but there's no concern, except for one sheet, there's no concern about a woman who's a nida sitting on her husband's bed sheets, because there's no halachic concerns about that. Why? As the smog writes, because the smog writes that the vlad is kasher legamrei. In other words, kasher legamrei. And the most commentators look at this and say that in order for there to be a Ben Nida challenge, there actually needs to be a act of intimacy. It's not enough just for the sperm to go into the Nida, there has to be an act of intimacy. Why is this important? This is important for two reasons. It's important for reason number one, because it shows you again that we treat the father, even if he didn't have an intimate act with the woman as the father of the child. It's also highlighting that a ben nida, the real challenge of a ben nida, is only when there is an actual sexual act, which answers a question that I mentioned about an IUI. What happens if an IUI, you remember that's the when you park the sperm at the fallopian tube, what happens if that's happening when the woman's ready to ovulate when she's still a nida? Can you do that procedure there? Since there's no sexual intercourse, there's no sexual interaction, there's no halakhic challenge with that. because there's no active intimacy, and there is an issue about giving birth to a ben nida. But many of the poskim suggest, since it's not so simple that this point I just mentioned, that if the family will understand what I'm about to say properly, then perhaps it's appropriate for the woman to go to the mikvah. Let's say normally this happens during her Shiva Nikiyam. She's in the middle of her Shiva Nikiyam, and she's ready to ovulate. It's towards the end of the Shiva Nikiyam, normally. So she's ready to ovulate, it's in the middle of the Shiva Nikiyam. You tell the woman, go to the mikvah. Then she has the IUI. She's no longer a nida from a biblical perspective, right? She's not a nida from a biblical perspective. You ovulate any challenge of the child being considered ben nida, but they cannot have any type of intimacy or touching until she finishes her Shiva Nikiyam, and then she goes to the mikvah again. Now, with a couple that is sensitive to these issues, and you're not afraid that they will have any type of intimacy, but they will listen to you to the letter of the law, that's what you tell them to do. With a couple that you're concerned that they won't listen to you to the letter of the law, it's better to have that IUI procedure and for her not to go to the mikvah beforehand. But if a couple, it depends on, you'll have, you know, most shuls have a rainbow, you know, bandwidth of members who will listen on various issues, right, Rabbi Schwartz? So the ones that you know will listen to these issues, you make one suggestion. The ones you know might not listen to those issues, you would not suggest going to the mikvah. So that you remove any of the halachic stigma maybe of it being a ben nida. This idea of a child being considered the paternity, the sperm donor, considered having a paternal relationship is also seen in the tshuva of the Tashbeit on source 7, which I leave for your perusal. Source number 8 is a Shilte Gevorim in Shavuos, on page 8, I'm sorry, is a Shilte Gevorim in Shavuos, where the Shilte Gevorim in Shavuos mentions that he is not happy that a child can be considered a ben nida even without acts of intimacy. And it's that one shita, which 99.9% of the people negate, which is the reason why I would tell you that in the case of an IUI where the woman is in the middle of her Shiva Nikiyam, and she's going to listen to you, Rachel Bitcha Katana, that you should tell her to go to the mikvah before she has the IUI procedure.
What was that?
She'll take a bar. Okay? And by the way, Rav Moshe Feinstein, for that reason, source number 9, explains that that's why the sperm donor should be a non-Jew. Because since its paternity is defined in a case of, since the paternity is defined, the definition is by the sperm donor, you don't want to be concerned about having children that are step-related to each other. And therefore, if you let a Jew be the sperm donor for 4 different people, now he has stepchildren from 4 different places, you're worried about Shema Yisa Basachoso. Maybe you're going to be marrying stepchildren to each other. But a guy, there's no yichus issues, and therefore you use non-Jewish sperm. Not everyone was happy with this Shuva Rav Moshe Feinstein. In fact, I think his house was firebombed for the Shuva. But nevertheless, he wrote this Shuva more than once. And it's found on page source on page 9, page 10, page 11. And actually, further in your handout, which we will not get to, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach writes the same thing on page 25 in the first volume of Noam. Anyone ever read Noam before? By show of hands, how many people read the Igros Moshe? By show of hands, how many people read Noam? Okay, it's pretty. The difference in the show of hands is why Rav Moshe got in trouble and Rav Shlomo Zalman didn't, because very few people have read Noam. The full article of Noam I've enclosed. It's page 25 through page whatever the page is through page 30 something, and you can read that. I would encourage you, if you're interested, to read that. Read that shuva. So if we move now fast to page number 12, we'll skip page number 12, we'll move to the Minchas Yitzchak on page 13. Page 12 is just bolstering the point I've just told you about so I don't need to do it again. Page 13, you have the Minchas Yitzchak, where the Minchas Yitzchak wants to highlight Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss was a member of the Eda Haredes Beis Din. Wants to remind everybody that anyone who has gone through a process like this, this process, even though there's no active intimacy, there's been great nishtablus, they are yotzei the mitzvah for Rabu. And again, highlights the idea, ubenohu l'chol davar. I remember once that I was interviewed on Israeli TV, thanks to Yeshiva University, and the guy asks me on camera the following issue, and that is, what happens if there is a couple, and by the way, in Israel, these procedures are covered by insurance. So it's, I've always told my friend Rabbi Fass that you can have a whole Nefesh for Nefesh campaign and IVF. But the bottom line is that Israel covers these. And by the way, when you have a fertilized egg at this stage, we don't have time to go into it, you can actually tell which one of these fertilized eggs are male or female. It's called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. At the end of this handout, there's an article on that, which you should read. So the question I got on Israeli television was, here you have a Haredi couple in Neir Sha'arim. They wanted insurance not only to cover this procedure, but also PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, because the husband was a Kohen, the sperm came from a non-Jew, and he wanted only to return to the womb of the woman only female embryos. Because what does he want? He doesn't want in shul when the kid's, you know, 13 years old and goes up, and he goes up to Duchen, that the kid doesn't go up to Duchen with him. It's going to look bad. So he only wants female embryos. Harav, Ma'atov Hoshev, should the government pay for this PGD procedure or not? Okay? But this is an example of the gifts of science that even allow you to deal with what I would call the psychological issues, not just the physiological issues. And in an article in Tradition on this issue, at the end of your handout, I discuss what I consider the parameters of PGD, and I have in here article letters from Rav Nevitzal and others that I quote from Rav Neuvert and others that were written to Machon Pua, letters that are not secret or I wouldn't share them with you, but they've never really been published. But I have permission to publish them for you. That discusses the protocols of using PGD. You know, let's say if you want to use it, you know, I can understand deciding which eggs have pay sacs in them, which don't have pay sacs in them. All right, let's say the husband and wife are carriers of pay sacs. Okay, they didn't do genetic screening, like all of you, of course, have already done, right? Right, they didn't do genetic screening. So now they have the pay sacs, they've had a pay sacs child up on Elislan. They want to get pregnant again, so they'll weed out which ones have the pay sacs and which ones don't have pay sacs. I can understand using PGD for that. But what about you want to do PGD because you have four rooms in your house and, you know, two are painted blue, one's painted pink, and you already have girls and you want boys. Or you want to be yotzei the mitzvah for Ravu or for Shalom Bias or for any other reasons. Or you like only blonde haired kids and you can tell which hair color there is. Can you use PGD for anything? When do we become HaKadosh Baruch Hu's junior partners versus becoming HaKadosh Baruch Hu's partners? So I would encourage you to go through that. So the Minchas Yitzchak in source 13 highlights the pieces I just mentioned about the idea that there is this notion of that Hazra'a Malchutit, that what's called, I think he's focusing more on IUI, but it's also IVF, that the issue of that a couple that's going to go through this fulfills the mitzvah of Peru Ravu. So we only have like 4 minutes left, and it's not going to allow me to do the Nod Bihuda and a few other things there because I want to do the definitions of maternity. I'll just mention the Nod Bihuda. The Nod Bihuda has a Shaila about Ibum and Chalitza, appropriate for those learning Yavamas, where he speaks about the fact that what happens if the sperm was donated for the fertilized egg after the person is no longer alive. Is the fetus from a sperm donor, does the sperm donor have to be alive at the point of conception? Maybe if the sperm donor has died 20 years ago, is it benohu l'chol davar? Are you still considered the father? So Noda Behuda has his approach, or people read into the Noda Behuda. He lived in the 1700s, so he wasn't talking about this, but people read into it. Then you have the Karen Ora that attacks the Noda Behuda, and then you have an article in Torah Sheval Peh where there's a conversation on this issue. That's the next few pages in the handout I've given you. The point is, there is no consensus on this issue, but there is this notion, can there be posthumous paternity? I died, you know, someone died 20 years ago, their sperm is cryopreserved, it's now given over to a woman, she fertilizes her egg with it. You know, is there a nachla relationship? Is there a yard site relationship? Is there other relationships whatsoever? Are you out of Yibun Chalitza if you use sperm donation? A husband goes to war, he dies, leaves her without children, but he expressed sperm before he went to war. Can you use that sperm to get out of Yibun Chalitza? That's the Noda Behuda issue. That's, you know, that the, all those issues, you know, are the contemporary halakhic issues. We paskin that actually you can't get out of Chalitza with that, but it might be Benohu Vachol Davar based on the Noda Behuda. And finally, how do we define maternity? How do we define who the mother is? Let's say these eggs are owned by Rachel, and this womb is owned by Leah. Who defines maternity? There are four approaches in halakha. Approach number one is, they are both the mothers. These are both the mothers. The gamete donor, and what we call the gestational mother, or the surrogate. They're both the mothers. That approach is not really followed by anyone other than the one who articulated it. Okay? I think that's it, so yes. Then there's one approach, or he might have approached this one, and that is, there's no mothers. Because it's not, that approach also is not really so much engaging. Then there is another approach that says, the same way the sperm donor is the father, the female gamete donor is the mother, and that you have a lot of poskim that say. It's interesting that that Rebbe Yashiv actually has, there's a piece that I quote from Rebbe Yashiv, who initially said that the definition of maternity is the host, the surrogate mother, and there have been articles in which there seems to be a switch in Rebbe Yashiv's perspective, where he's now moved from this perspective to the one who donates the gametes, is it? Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, have all very strongly said that the definition of maternity, and by the way, so has Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, has said also the definition of the mother is the gestational carrier, the surrogate mother. And their opinions are based on various sugyas, one particular Yavamas, where we see if a woman converts when she's pregnant, while there is a disassociation between the father and the fetuses, because at the moment of immersion, relationships that have been established are in some ways cut. The relationship between the mother and the fetuses are not cut, which is a proof, according to Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, that the definition of maternity is the gestational carrier, and since at the point of tefillah, the relationship is still evolving, therefore it has not been severed. You have Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who says, at the point in which this fetus is 40 days old, the donor, which is at the point in which we move from Maya Ba'alma until the definition of a fetus, this mother is no longer part of the picture. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, his words, and it's all in the handout, view this mother as no different as if it was made in Japan, a gift from Japan, Tutseret Yapan. It is not part of the picture anymore when this fetus is 40 days old. And then there are several other approaches, several other rayas. One final one, well, I'm not even going to mention that final one, it's an interesting Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel, which doesn't really hold too much, I don't think it's a real solid proof, but it is used by it is used by those that started Eretz Chaim, the Kol Eretz Chaim, the very short who started it? No. Rav Shaul Yisraeli uses this proof, and that is, I use the Rachel and Leah. So if you look at the Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel, the Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel says that initially Yosef was in the womb of Leah, and Dina was in the womb of Rachel. The Hislaplu Ubraya, and there was a interuterine exchange, and Yosef was put into the womb of Rachel at the request of Leah, and Dina was put in the womb of Leah at the request of Leah, so that Rachel would not have less shvatim than the shvachot, than the Bilhah and Zilpah. And says Rav Shaul Yisraeli, no one ever considers Yosef the child of Leah, even though the genetic gift of Yosef came from Leah, not from Rachel. We don't use a gadata to prove halachas. But my point is the following. There is no final conclusion on this issue. And therefore, any time that I've ever done had a situation in which the donor of the eggs is not Jewish, or the donor of the eggs is not Jewish, even though I am of the opinion, you know, and greater people than me are not of this opinion, that it's the gestational carrier, I will always make sure a conversion is done misafek. Why? Because since this is an evolving process, so let's say you have a nice young lady, she's born tomorrow, and her eggs came from a non-Jew, and the gestational carrier is a Jew, her mother, the one who's going to raise her. Who says in 20 years, so you do a Geirus Misafek. If the normative approach that is that it wasn't necessary, she still married Goy, it was just a dump in the mikvah for no reason. And if the normative approach is now going to be that the definition of mother is the female gametes, well, maybe in 20 years from now she's not going to be so religious. And when she's going to want to get married, she won't be able to convert her, because halakhically, she won't be a candidate for conversion. So Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, in the fifth volume of Tchumim, says, even though I follow this approach, I would suggest that anybody in which there is female gametes come from a non-Jew, you do conversion misafek in order to make sure that you're not koshering a baby only according to one approach, and disqualifying a baby according to another approach.
What about Mary Kedushin?
So that I'll let the Masada Kedushin in 20 years deal with that challenge. But I at least have covered my bases. From my perspective, I actually had a conversation with Rabbi Boyd about this on Shabbos. So he said to me that if they're both not Jewish, he wouldn't be comfortable being Masada Kedushin. But there are more than enough poskim, and I think this would be the perspective of the Hopua, that if this mother was Jewish, even if the female gametes came from a non-Jew, they would do chuppah kedusha without a problem.
With the
kohen. But the problem, my issue is that there's no one who's gone through these procedures that's getting married yet. Right? These procedures are too new. That problem is not going to come up for 10 years from now, or 5 years, 10 years from now, I don't know exactly when this procedure started. But it's now happening all the time. In 20 years from now, the contemporary halakha class should be focused on, do you marry such a person? That will be Rabbi Schwartz's problem. I promise you it will not be mine. Okay? That's not going to be my problem is that right now the Rabbanim need to know that don't create a situation where she's only Jewish according to one approach and not Jewish according to another approach, because if you do that, you don't know in 20 years where she'll be and whether you can, press a reset button on the issue. Take one more question. I'm a little bit over on time, so we'll take this question and we'll end.
Is this all assuming that you can't find a Jewish surrogate?
It's Jewish surrogate is very, sometimes hard. You have to make sure, by the way, that there's challenges with Jewish surrogate also, but if you use an egg of a single woman, it's not a challenge, but you need to know who that woman is. Or you won't know the woman is because of confidentiality, but you at least need to know some information. You need, for example, to know she was born on April 18th, 1982. All right, just throwing out a date. in New York City, Mount Sinai Hospital. So when this child gives birth and is going out with somebody, let's say it's a boy, he's going out with a girl, he brings the girl home, so the parents can ask, by the way, your mother, where was she born? So if she was born in Chicago, you're in great shape. If she was born in New York, find out which hospital and what date it was. You know, I mean, you can do genetic stuff also, but the bottom line is, you don't want to deal with, you have to make sure there's no Shema Yisa Basachoso issues. But those are easy to deal with if you follow those protocols that I just established. I was at the Ritz Yarchei Kala for Shavuos, and I gave a class on infertility and halacha. I had three or four couples come over to me after I gave the class, all with fertility challenges. It was more important than anything I did on the thing. And one of them actually is going through this process in which they're using donor eggs from a Jew that they were able to find out for sure that the yichus was proper Jewish yichus. They don't know the person's name, but they know birth date and the dates of the hospital and stuff like that, so that when their child is born, b'shat tovah v'slachas, and they go out, they'll be able to check those issues. Yes, it has to be single. Okay, we'll stop here. Have a good day.